the station bringing you Tag for Swag.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Brian Lin has a report about Ukraine's recapture of Kherson. Faith Perlow presents this week's health and lifestyle report. She also joins me later to discuss her report. We close the show with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Brian Lin.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited the southern city of Kherson Monday to celebrate its recent recapture from Russian forces. Walking the streets of the city, Zelensky met with soldiers and took pictures with citizens. "This is the beginning of the end of the war," he said. "We are step by step coming to all the temporarily occupied territories." Zelensky added, "We are moving forward. We are ready for peace, peace for all of our country." He admitted, however, that the town's recapture came at a heavy price. "The fighting," he said, "had taken the best heroes of our country." Zelensky thanked NATO and other allies for their support and for providing military assistance. He said the arrival of movable rocket systems from the United States had made a big difference in Ukraine's war effort. The retaking of Kherson marks one of Ukraine's biggest successes in its war against Russia. Russian forces invaded Ukraine in February. But large parts of eastern and southern Ukraine are still under Russian control. Even Kherson remains within reach of Russian shells and missiles. Heavy fighting was reported elsewhere in the country, with Ukraine reporting civilian deaths and injuries. Families gathered in Kherson's main square to celebrate Russia's withdrawal. Some stood in front of the main government building, which until recently was occupied by Russian forces. Many people carried Ukrainian flags, which had been banned in public under Russia's occupation. Yevhen Telyazenko lives in Kherson with his family. He told the Associated Press he did not feel safe flying his Ukrainian flag outside his home while Russia controlled the city. But on Monday, the 73-year-old and his wife drove around the city flying the flag. The couple stopped to get Ukrainian soldiers who liberated the city to write their names on the flag. "They were fighting for us. We knew we were not alone," Telyazenko said. His wife, 61-year-old Tatiana Hitina, added, "Finally, freedom." While the liberation of Kherson brought excitement and hope, the situation remains difficult. On Monday, the city had no power and water. Food and medicines were in short supply. Life is expected to be hard for weeks to come as winter arrives and energy supplies for heat are limited. Kherson was the only provincial capital that was captured by Russia. Russia seized the city in the first weeks of the invasion. It was an important gain for Russia because the city is situated in a strategic position on the Dnieper River. The Dnieper's wide waters now separate Ukrainian troops from the city's former occupiers. I'm Brian Lynn.
There is a growing debate among scientists about how people face difficulties and recover from them. The word resilience describes the ability to deal with stress and to recover from it. The researchers are asking, why do some people recover and others struggle after traumatic events such as child abuse, gun violence, or the spread of disease? They want to know whether the ability to recover from stress is in our nature, in our genes, or in the way we were brought up by our parents, how we were nurtured. Research suggests that both nature and nurture are responsible for creating resilience. But researchers say neither guarantees recovery from hardship. The American Psychological Association says anyone can learn resilience through kinds of behaviors, thoughts, and actions, but that it is not always easy. In the mid-1990s, research in the United States connected negative childhood experiences with problems in adulthood, like poor mental and physical health. The research also said that each additional negative experience increased risk later on. Many studies have tried to answer why some children are more at risk for some bad experiences than others. Dr. Thomas Boyce is a researcher and treats children in California. He wanted to find the answer to that question because of his own family. He was very close to his younger sister. They experienced a difficult childhood. As they grew up, Boyce's life seemed to progress. But his sister experienced struggles and mental problems. Boyce said he discovered 1 in 5 children have a higher biological response to stress. He said they show signs of too much activity in the brain's fight or flight response and in stress hormones. Observers say that children like these have higher rates of physical and mental problems when raised in a stressful family environment. Boyce said that additional evidence suggests that these sensitive children do very well with nurturing and supportive parenting. Ananda Amstatter is a researcher at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond. She studies traumatic stress and genetics, the study of genes. She said that her research suggests genes and environment equally influence resilience. She said that there is no single resilience gene, and that many genes are probably involved. Terry Moffitt and Avshalom Kaspi are researchers at Duke University in the state of North Carolina. They have found a connection between differences in genes that help to control emotions, and a higher risk for depression or bad behavior in children who experience abuse. Dr. Dennis Sharney studies ways to overcome difficulties in life. He also works at Mount Sinai Health System in the state of New York. He said that our genes are not destiny. Trauma can affect the development of areas in the brain that control anxiety and fear. Treatments like talk therapy and medication can help people who have experienced trauma. Sharney also said that a loving family, good friends, and a positive experience in school could correct the negative effects. Steve Biondolillo is now a 19-year-old college student. He spent his early life in Haiti. His family was poor, and he experienced other trauma. At the age of 4, his biological parents sent him to an orphanage, where he lived for 3 years. He said this experience was traumatic for him. "I didn't really understand what was happening," he said. "I just got thrown into a big house full of other kids." He said that he remembers feeling afraid and alone. He thought he would have to live there forever. Then came the 2010 Haiti earthquake. The disaster killed more than 100,000 people and destroyed the capital and other towns. "All the hope that I had suddenly vanished," Biondolillo said. Biondolillo survived, and he was adopted by an American family that took him to the United States. His new life gave him many opportunities, but he was still frightened by past traumas from Haiti. His adoptive parents wanted to help, so they got him and his brother involved in an after-school program at the local Boys and Girls Club, where they could have fun. The adults there were supportive, and he talked about his experiences. He said that they made him feel supported and loved. Now Steve is in his second year of college. He is studying social work. He wants to give back to society by helping and nurturing others. Biondolillo said that his life has been a path from being a fearful child to a proud young man with big goals and a big future. I'm Faith Perlow.
You just heard Faith Perlow present this week's Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm excited to welcome Faith to the program to talk more about her story. Hi, Faith. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Ashley. I'm glad to be here.
One phrase I heard you use in the story was fight or flight response. Can you explain what that means?
Of course. So, when we sense a danger or threat, a certain part of our brain gets activated. The brain's response prepares the body to fight the threat or flee the threat. To flee means to run away from danger. Flight is the related noun. It might help to have an example. The other day, I found a huge, scary spider in my kitchen. There are two ways I could have reacted. I could have run away, screaming. That's the flight part of the response. Or I could stay and fight him. Actually, I just picked him up in a glass and put him back outside. That's the fight part of the response.
Well, I'm glad you and the spider stayed safe. How can someone tell if they are in a fight-or-flight response?
We can physically feel it sometimes. Our heart will start to beat quicker and harder. We might get sweaty. And our muscles might tense up. These are all reactions to the stress response.
Thanks for those helpful answers, Faith. And thanks again for joining me today. Come back again soon.
Thanks for having me.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In November of 1840, the American people elected William Henry Harrison as their 9th president. Harrison was a retired general and a well-known Indian fighter. Many people considered him a hero for his victory over Native Americans at the Battle of Tippecanoe in 1811. Americans elected John Tyler as Harrison's vice president. The two men ran on the campaign slogan, Tippecanoe and Tyler too. Harrison was the first president from the Whig Party. Some Whig leaders, including Senators Henry Clay and Daniel Webster, believed they could control the newly elected president. Harrison asked Daniel Webster to edit the speech he planned to give after the swearing-in ceremonies. Webster removed some material from the inaugural speech and suggested other changes. The inauguration took place on March 4th, 1841. It was the coldest inaugural day in the nation's history. Harrison spoke on the front steps of the Capitol building. He gave the longest inaugural address of any president. It lasted almost 2 hours. But Harrison did not wear a winter overcoat or hat. He got sick, probably from standing so long outside in the cold. Rest was his best treatment. But the new president was so busy, he had little time to rest. Harrison's health grew worse. Late in March 1841, he developed pneumonia. Doctors did everything they could to cure him, but nothing seemed to help. On April 4th, exactly 1 month after he became president, William Henry Harrison died. Vice President John Tyler was then at his home in Williamsburg, Virginia. Daniel Webster, the new Secretary of State, sent his son on horseback to tell Tyler of the president's death. The vice president was shocked. He had not even known that Harrison was sick. 2 hours after he received the news, Tyler was on his way to Washington. There was some question about Tyler's official duties. Harrison's death marked the first time that a president had died in office. No one was sure what the Constitution meant when it said that the powers of a deceased president should go to the vice president. Eventually, Tyler, Webster, and other cabinet members decided that Tyler should be president and serve until the next election.
That was a very controversial claim because people said, no, he's not the president. He's an acting president. He's just temporarily filling the office, but he's not president.
Historian Michael Holt taught at the University of Virginia. He says, Although not everyone supported John Tyler's claim, he set an important example. He showed how power could transfer peacefully to the vice president after a U.S. president died in office. Tyler was sworn in as the nation's 10th president on April 6, 1841. He was 51 years old. No other man had become president at such an early age. Tyler was a slaveholding Southerner. He was born and grew up in the same part of Virginia as William Henry Harrison. His father was a wealthy landowner and judge who had been a friend of Thomas Jefferson. Tyler completed studies at the College of William and Mary and became a lawyer. He entered politics and served in the Virginia State Legislature. Then he was elected a member of Congress and later governor of Virginia. He also served as a member of the United States Senate. Tyler believed strongly in the rights of the states. As a congressman and a senator, he had voted against every attempt to give more power to the federal government. In fact, historian Michael Holt says that in many ways, Tyler was more like a member of the Democrats, the opposing party at the time.
He favored the typical position of Democrats on what we could call domestic policy, which is that government is best which governs least. The less federal domestic policy you have trying to generate economic growth or improve society or whatever, the better.
In comparison, many Whig Party members firmly supported the ideas of a national bank, a protective tax on imports, and federal spending to improve transportation in the states. Tyler was just as firmly against these ideas. At the same time, many Democrats did not like the president either.
Most Democrats regarded him as a traitor who had jumped from the Jackson Party and joined the Whigs, however temporarily.
Michael Holt says even Tyler's appearance made him seem difficult and unpleasant.
You look at this guy and he's sort of aesthetically thin and with sunken cheeks and a long pointed nose. He just looks like he's unhappy with the world.
President Tyler quickly became even more unpopular over the issue of a new national bank. He wanted to establish such a bank in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. The national bank could open offices in a state, but only if the state approved. Tyler's proposal was not the kind of bank most Whigs in Congress supported. They wanted no limits of any kind on the power of a national bank to open offices anywhere in the country. Whigs in Congress suggested a compromise. Bank offices would be permitted in any state where the state legislature did not immediately refuse permission. But President Tyler vetoed the compromise. He sent the bank bill back to Congress. The congressman wrote another bill. They said it was exactly what the president wanted. But the president did not agree. He said the states must have the right to approve or reject bank offices. He said this second bill would also be vetoed unless changes were made in it. The changes were not made, and Tyler did as he said he would do. He vetoed it. The decision created a crisis in the cabinet. All the president's advisors but one, Daniel Webster, resigned. Michael Holt says that several days later, most cabinet members and a large group of other Whig congressmen voted to expel Tyler from the party.
They read this paper saying he's no Whig. Don't blame us for all of his vetoes.
Harrison appointed a new cabinet of Whigs he hoped would be more friendly to him, but after a while, they too resigned. Michael Holt says Tyler made more changes in his cabinet than any other U.S. president. President Tyler struggled with his party over other issues. One was about import taxes. 2 years into Tyler's presidency, the government found itself short of money. It was spending more than it had. Congress decided that import taxes should be raised, some even higher than 20%. But President Tyler vetoed the bill. He said it was wrong to raise the tax so high and, at the same time, continue to give the states money from land sales. He said the federal government itself needed the land sale money. Michael Holt says once again the Whigs were angry. Their party controlled both houses of Congress and the White House, but they could not reach their goals.
The Whigs were elected with this agenda that they wanted Congress to pass that they had promised would rescue the country from a very serious depression. And this included a new national bank, higher tariffs, distribution of federal revenues from public land sales.
President Tyler, he adds, frustrated the entire Whig legislative program. It was clear the Whigs would not nominate him for the next election, so Tyler turned his attention to the Democrats. He hoped they would ask him to be their presidential candidate in 1844. Tyler began appointing Democratic advisors to his cabinet, and he gave his support to one of the Democrats' causes, making Texas a state in the Union. Texas was an independent nation at the time. Some Americans wanted to bring Texas into the United States to further expand the country. But others were afraid that the territory would permit slavery. They wanted to keep an equal balance between slaveholding and non-slaveholding states. President Tyler had the opposite fear. Michael Holt explains that Tyler was afraid that Texas would remain an independent republic and abolish slavery there.
He and other Southerners thought that that was a terrible idea. But he also believed that this is what's going to put him in the history books, that he's going to be responsible for adding this enormous Republic of Texas, although it wasn't quite as big as what they claimed, to the United States.
I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
That's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.